If you're just joining us, this is a WBAI special commemorating the Armenian Genocide. Harry Mazadorian is a lawyer and a national authority in alternative dispute resolution.
I grew up in New Britain, Connecticut, where we had a good-sized Armenian population. Both my parents were genocide survivors, both from the province of Harput or Kharpert, and nearby villages. One was the village of Ichman, one was the village of Yereki. We have a number of people in New Britain from both those villages. My parents did not know each other in the old country, met here. They had a very different path to the United States. They came, my mother survived and was in an orphanage, did not know that her father, who had come to this country to earn a fortune for the family, where he was, and he did not know she had survived. He found her sometime later in her teens and brought her here. My father's father was an American citizen. He had come here twice. I can't remember the dates, but first time about the Spanish-American War, after the first Armenian massacre started around 1896, came to the United States. We tracked down where he was, went back, came here once more, and then went back again with very bad timing. He was taken away and killed when my father was about 9. Some of the stories are, we talk about what we heard and what we, which parents were more willing to speak. I'd heard some stories from my folks, and one particularly from my father, that I respectfully listened to, but I didn't really think it could happen. One of the three young Turks who led the assault on the Armenians was Enver Pasha. And the story my father tells was that in about 1916, a year after the genocide began, Enver Pasha came to Ichmea. And I'm thinking, well, why would Enver Pasha go to Ichmea? My grandmother had some documents which demonstrated that my grandfather was an American citizen. And she bribed her way into the dinner where Enver Pasha was meeting with some big shots and said to Enver Pasha, when she got in, "I'm the wife of an American citizen." Something about, I'd like safe passage. Well, he was all smiles, Enver Pasha, and said, "Oh, come closer, come closer, you're an American." And then he turned, almost pathologically, he turned and said, "This woman's an American, why is she still alive?" And kicked him out. A few years ago, I'm reading the notes, the comments, the memoirs of Leslie Davis, United States Consul to Harper. And he tells of two meetings with Enver Pasha. Same time, could this be? You know, I read on, and Enver Pasha says to him, as he documents in his memoirs, now this is the U.S. Consul, "Tell me, Mr. Davis, how do you spend your time?" "Oh, I go horseback riding." "Ah, tell me about your horseback riding." And Leslie Davis tells him. And again, Enver Pasha is this congenial guy, welcoming comments. And then he turns, again in this pathological way. He says, "And when you go riding, do you send your letters to the Americans telling them what's going on in Turkey?" Leslie Davis knew that many of his messages had been intercepted by the Turks, but he didn't know that he'd been watched by Enver Pasha. So here are these two different people, my grandmother and Leslie Davis, talking to this madman who welcomes them with his, you know, glowing comments, "Tell me more about yourself," and then turns in a rage and dismisses them. I'm thinking, wow, the story was true. The stories that we heard are, you know, pretty similar. Barbaric, consistent. As lawyers, we look for consistency and determining the trustworthiness of stories we hear. And the consistency in these stories is just remarkable. My mother's story is a little different. She was actually in the death march, but she was given away by her mother. It's a little hard for me to talk about. She lived with Arabs and then went to an orphanage, remarkably survived the genocide, survived the collapse of the orphanage in Yereki. The building just fell down around her. And then they were all going to Greece, and the boat almost sank. And I think Ruth Swisher's mother was on the same boat. When they got to Greece, they found that the folks there had already held a requiem service for her. They weren't dead, but they made it. They all ended up with safe passage to this country, but they went through some very, very grueling times. And if there's one theme that comes throughout all this, it's just barbarism. Now, you know, the story that's told the current Turkish government, and some of it was told by the Ottoman government, was that it was not a genocide. It was a deportation, that the citizens who were being deported were well cared for. And if any of this happened, it was those Kurds. I mean, we wouldn't do that. The Turks wouldn't do that, but you never know what those Kurds are going to do. But as the stories unfold from all of the survivors, they were the Turkish military and the police and the brigands and those who were released from prisons who just came upon the Armenians, and this terrible fate befell them. You know, both my parents remember the last time they saw their parents.
My name is Agnes Barsoyan Karanian, and I was born in Pawtucket, Rhode Island. Hustian was my mother. Her name was Hustian Hayotsian. She married at a very young age, which was customary at her time, to Mirjan Yerian. She had her first child, Yerishe, Ernest, at age 17. Soon after that, she had two more sons named Hagop and Barkev. She also had three daughters named Hrepsimeh, Aznif, and when Aznif died, she named another daughter Aznif because she loved that name. Another child was born en route when the family was being deported from their hometown of Zaras, Sivas. Mirjan insisted they give the baby to a Turk or a Kurd, but she refused, saying, "This baby was born a Christian and will die a Christian." And she wrapped the baby up and put it under a tree, and I was 12 years old, and I would be crying. "How could you do that?" And she said, "Achigas, I couldn't take care of the older children, let alone take care of the baby." She was very religious. She was very, you know, a real good Christian. The relocation march began, and in an effort to protect her husband from being taken away and killed, she dressed him as a woman. Despite the disguise, he was detected and stoned to death in front of the rest of her children. They watched in horror, and they wept as he was murdered at the hands of the Ottoman Turks. As the family proceeded on their relocation march, their food supply dwindled. The younger children died of hunger and thirst, while the two other children persevered. They were a bit older, and they were able to withstand the hunger and the thirst, I guess. Hustian, who had already suffered great pain, was dealt with another devastating blow when Hagop was kidnapped by a Kurdish family. A sympathetic Kurdish woman informed Hustian that she knew of Hagop's whereabouts. With this kind woman's help, Hustian and Yerusher, her oldest son, found their way to Hagop. Yerusher and his mother did everything to persuade Hagop to come home with them, but he balked, saying that they were his family now, and nothing they said could change his mind. They did bring him home, but he ran away, back to this Kurdish family. When there was an opportunity for one person to board a ship coming to America, Hustian insisted that Yerusher go. He didn't want to leave without her, but she insisted, saying, "Go. Don't worry about me. I will be fine. It's important for you to get to America." For a couple of years, she worked as a nurse's aide in Adana, Turkey. And in 1921, she was able to book a passage to America under the name of Minasyan, a relative of her late husband. She lived in Milford, Massachusetts. She had many bachelor suitors who wanted to marry her, but she refused them all. Eventually, Hustian, Oscar, a widower, came asking for a hand in marriage. Although she did not know him personally, she had heard the Barsoyans in her town of Zara Sepastia, now known as Sivas. She agreed to marry him, and on July 23, 1923, they were married. They lived at 26 Dunnell Lane, Pawtucket, Rhode Island, in Oskian's father's house. Agnes was born there on May 25, 1924. A year later, Hustian built a house on Prospect Street in Pawtucket and moved in. Harry was born 3.5 years later in the same house on November 19, 1928. Father Hustian died November 26, 1950, and Mother Hustian died September 9, 1959. Harry died February 23, 1928. So, anyway, I would cry, and she'd say, "Don't cry. I just want to tell you so you'll know."
The subject is so painful, even to my generation, who were born and brought up in America with all the freedoms of America, that those of us who know stories, some of us can't even talk about those stories because it hurts so much, and we don't want to hurt other members of our families who are also involved. We're faced with this, and unfortunately, this helps the denial of what happened. Because if we can't talk about it, if we can't write about it, then it didn't happen. But it did happen, and we all know it happened.
My name is Roxy Garabedian, and I'm from New Britain, Connecticut. My family came from İçme, which is a little village in Turkey, part of Harput, the state, and then the country of Turkey. Because my grandfather, Baram Baramyan, worked in New Britain as a P&F Corbin, my mother's father and my father's father together, he couldn't get back into this country, so he took his family to Mexico. They went to El Oro, which is a little town outside of Mexico City. And with them, they took a lot of nieces and nephews and other people. They had one big house there. The church was very, very important to us. We always went to church on Sunday, to the Armenian church. When we went to church, we got into Armenian school. We learned how to read and write, and we got our Armenian history through there, either through the priest of the church at the time or through one of the teachers, Sunday school teachers, whatever have you. But we went to a lot of Armenian functions, a hantes, which was a program of a play or some kind of a musical or lecture or whatever have you. But this was very often, or a picnic, with family gathering or people in the community gathering, things like that. We always were proud to be Armenian. We had a store in New Britain on North Street, and all the Armenians used to come to my father's store, either to bring, my father had a tailor shop and cleaning, either they would bring clothes to be cleaned or tailored, or else they would just come to visit and and commiserate over their stories and telling one another about their happenings and finding relatives or whatever have you. When they would come to visit us, and if we had coffee, over the coffee table, a lot of the stories were exchanged. Most of the time, the parents didn't want to talk about it. It was just too hard and too painful for them to tell a story. Sometime you might hear of a story. Like my father's mother, she remembered taking my father and my aunt, who were over there in the genocide, to some Turkish woman, let her in to her house and hid them because the Turks would knock on the door and say, if there's any Armenians, gavurs, not a very nice word for the Armenians, they would kill them. So she would hide them in the house. And that's how she escaped. And she escaped, took some other nieces too with her, as much as she could. But that's what they did. They really had tough times. They were out in the fields, sleeping and living and walking through and seeing a lot of dead bodies on the side of the road. That was not uncommon at all. I remember a family member, my mother's sister's husband, who came from the Persian part of Iran, Armenian. He was an orphan, and he would hide in a well. It wouldn't come out at all. People would lower food down to him so he could survive. And it was until days after, when things kind of quieted down, that he could come out and be on Earth. But I remember him saying that. That part I do remember.
The Turkish Nationalist Party, in its 1915 General Assembly, devised a multi-pronged plan by which to render Armenians extinct. The plan forbade Armenians to travel and called for the confiscation of arms and personal wealth. A list of Armenians to be massacred was sent daily to the Ministry of the Interior to provide a daily toll of those killed and those still living. The plan also included taking attractive Armenian brides and virgins into Turkish harems. There, many gave birth to children fathered by their masters. In the book Armenian Golgotha, Grigoris Balakian, one of the intellectuals who was arrested along with some 250 other leaders, wrote that, quote, "The young brides and virgins were yanked from the embrace of their crying mothers and taken to Turkish harems. Even 10-year-old girls were subjected to all manner of savage, unbearable Turkish debauchery."
They were taken away to a farmhouse and they had no water. They asked for water and they asked for a bucket and they gave my father a baby's bonnet saying, go get water. And this was a porous bonnet. Again, a cruel trick. So he managed to bring some water back, and then as he came back, I think he was coming to the farmhouse, and these bunch of young Turks went after him with they had their swords. My grandmother yelled out to my father, "Be careful!" And then she yelled to them, "What are you doing?" They said, "Oh, don't worry, we're not going to do anything to him. We're just going to cut his head off." And then they came after him, and she said, "Run! Run, vaze, vaze." And he did. My brother recorded some of my father's comments, and it was I think you call it a cat and mouse game, that the Turks would allow you to bribe them, and then they'd let you go. And they know that there was more money, because every one of these survivors tells identical stories of having sewn coins into their clothing, and they let you go, and then they catch you, and they say, bribe me again, so that it was like a cat playing with a mouse, that they'd catch you, they'd let you go, then they catch you again. The conditions were terrible. I mean, there was no food. I mean, it wasn't just the deportation. I mean, there were actual plenty of killing going around, and each man, where my father was from, they took the man up to the mountain, and you know, Jenny's heard the story, and they just shot him point blank range, and many were killed. There were some of the stories about killing were barbaric. The efficiency of the Turks was remarkable. They used to play a game: how many babies could they kill on one sword? I mean, they didn't want to kill them individually, but they would try to line up a few infants and kill as many as they could with one sword, making sport of it.
Although there has been much academic recognition of the genocide, this has not always been followed by governmental and media recognition. The Obama administration recently cited its relations with Turkey in justifying blockage of the passage of a resolution that passed the House of Representatives. In 2007, a similar resolution also passed the House Foreign Relations Committee. The Bush administration, and now the Obama administration, claim that such passage would be detrimental to the so-called war on terror and would harm relations with their ally, Turkey. Both Bill Clinton and Barack Obama had pledged that their administrations would be the first to formally recognize the genocide. Yet once in office, each renounced their promise. And past resolutions have also failed. In 2000, the United States was using its bases in Turkey to patrol no-fly zones in Iraq. In 1985 and 1987, resolutions failed because U.S. bases in Turkey were considered crucial in monitoring the Soviet Union. As Stephen Zunes wrote in the Huffington Post, some United States policies have actually done greater harm to relations with Turkey than this symbolic resolution recognizing events of the past. In 2003, the U.S. secretly backed an attempted military coup by right-wing Turkish officers, arming Iraqi and Iranian Kurds with close ties to Kurdish rebels in Turkey, responsible for the deaths of thousands of Turkish citizens. The United States also invaded neighboring Iraq. Zunes noted that as a result, the percentage of Turks who view the United States positively declined from 52% to only 9%. Turks have been taught for decades that there was no genocide, with the result that most Turks believe their country is being treated unfairly. Zunes pointed out that failure to acknowledge the genocide is a disservice not only to survivors, but also to those Turks who tried to stop it, and those Turks today who face imprisonment for publicly mentioning the genocide. Roughly half the world's 3 million or so Armenians are living outside the post-communist Republic of Armenia. Communities exist in North America, the Middle East, Russia, Poland, Western Europe, and India. And in 2008, Armenia created an official diaspora ministry.
And it hasn't been until, I would say, recently that they are publicizing as much as they are because they were afraid. And even now, they are terrorized by the Turks. When there's a big fear of the Armenians or gathering, the Turks come to listen to what was being said, make sure that they don't say any derogatory remarks about the Turks. We had a person come to a lecture at the New Britain Library, and we'd say, why are you here? And he would say, I'm here to hear what you people have to say about the Turks and what's going on.
There was a lot of American interest in what happened to the survivors of the genocide. Much of it general humanitarian, eleemosynary help, not so much from the government. The government was trying to maintain its neutrality for a good period of time. There were an awful lot of people who helped. Were there Turks who helped? Yeah, there were. Arabs, Armenians, there were lots who came to the assistance of the Armenians in the genocide, but there just weren't enough of them, so many of them perished.
The issue of forgiveness is a difficult one, with some Armenians acknowledging that the crimes committed so long ago were under a different government. Yet all agree that without a formal recognition of what happened, and with a continuing denial by the Turkish government for the crimes of their forebears, forgiveness remains elusive. The Armenian Revolutionary Federation, Tashnag or Dashnak, had the goal of unifying numerous small groups in the Ottoman Empire working to defend Armenian villages from the widespread massacres. The party helped create the Democratic Republic of Armenia in 1917, the one that only lasted until 1920. But its leadership was exiled, and the federation then helped Armenian diaspora communities maintain their cultural identity. With the fall of the Soviet Republic, the Federation returned to Armenia, where it currently has a significant presence as the leading opposition party in the Armenian parliament. It is a staunch supporter of Armenian nationalism and works for the recognition of the genocide. Hasmik Bogosyan Solano, an Armenian living in San Diego, recalls how her mother was aware of secret late-night meetings at her parents' house. My mother's name was Baidzar. The word Baidzar means sunshine, and she was that. Warm and bright, ever-present, a source of high energy. She was born in Gerasun, a village on the Black Sea, to affluent parents who owned almond and filbert orchards. They were very involved in the life of the village. Her father hired townspeople and considered them family, not employees. Her mother was religious, kind, and generous. She would stand outside the church on Sunday morning, calling for alms for the poor. Her parents were very active in working for protection of the Armenian minority. And since it was against the law for minorities to assemble, she said she remembered that men would come to their house in the middle of the night and have secret, whispered meetings upstairs. The father of the poet, Silva Gabudijan, was one of those men. Many years and many worlds later, she would be told by an older cousin that those men were members of the Armenian Revolutionary Federation, just as George Washington was an American revolutionary for his country. Although she was never included in those meetings, because children were seen and not heard, she told me she remembered a Turkish and a German officer on horseback coming to their home, her mother falling down on her knees before them crying and begging them not to follow through on the plans their countries had made for the systematic genocide of the Armenians. The world doesn't listen to saints now, and it didn't listen to them then, and the genocide of the Armenian people began.
Why would I grow up hating the Turks if she didn't tell us stories? Well, then we must have been told something that we hated the Turks.
I don't like Turks per se because of what they did to our people, but I do enjoy the culture. You know, I loved being in Istanbul. I really did. Absolutely. It's what we're used to. If you haven't been there, you don't know what we're talking about. We sat down to a meal. I thought my mother was in the kitchen cooking. Honest to Pete, I really did. And there were Kurds that were cooking the meal. Remember when we went to the Isle of Kanali? It was marvelous. I would be absolutely delighted if the American government recognized the genocide. It would mean a lot to us first-generation Armenians. I don't think we'll ever see it, but I do really believe that.
I don't know. I don't have to think about forgiveness. Let me say this. I feel a little queasy around Turkish people. Let me say that. If someone is not sorry for what they've done, how can you forgive them?
I'm hoping they're really sincere and admitting it for the future. I have hope that the Turkish government will recognize it, make atonement for what their ancestors did. They didn't do it. It's this generation is not our enemy. I feel a little warmer as I grow older towards a Turk.
I think I've become more religious because of it, whether it's my mother's teachings or whatever. She taught me many, many prayers in Armenian, and till this day, I say them every morning. That's one. Yeah. Oh Lord, open up my lips to show forth thy praise. Derye te shirtunasis, padats peranasis, yevyerketses zortnatunat kor. But that's what I say every morning when I wash my face. And I had prayers that she taught me before going to bed. I was just a little thing.
We wish to thank WBAI for their commitment to recognizing the Armenian genocide and are grateful to the following individuals for opening their hearts and sharing the difficult memories of the past. Jenny Garabedian, Harry Mazadorian, Roxy Garabedian, Lucy Simonian, Roxy Maljanian, Mary Abrahamian, John Maljanian, Agnes Karanian, Ruth Swisher, and Artie Shaverdian. We'd also like to thank producer Jeff Brady.